In Vancouver, I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. In June, my guests now, Andy Lamb and Phil Edgell, published the second edition of their book, Coastal Fishes of the Pacific Northwest. In this revised and expanded edition, they include detailed sketches and vivid photographs of over 200 fish species with detailed information on their habitat, physical characteristics, behavior, as well as location. What was also interesting to read were the cooking ideas for most of the species. I'm not a fisher nor a consumer of fish, but this book is a great view onto the vast numbers of species up and down the coast, as well as fish found in the United States, whether it's Alaska or Washington and Oregon, even Northern California. Joining me now from Thetis Island, British Columbia, Andy Lamb is a marine naturalist who's worked at the Vancouver Aquarium and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Phil Edgell is a photographer who's also worked at the DFO, and his photographs have appeared in sundry publications. He joins us today from Port Alberni, B.C. They've each co-authored other books for Harbor Publishing, who published this book. Weeks after getting it, I find myself sitting at my desk, thumbing through it, looking up species and viewing the great photographs. I'm very pleased to have both authors on the program this morning. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Andy Lamb and Phil Edgell. Good morning, Mr. Lamb.
Good morning.
And good morning, Mr. Edgell.
Good morning.
Thanks both for joining us. Phil, I'll start with you and the front of the book. What is that?
A wolf eel. A male wolf eel. Yeah.
And they're actually quite long, right?
Yep. I believe, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, but probably up to about 2 meters in length they can get. That's probably an adult you're looking at there.
Yeah, and it looks old. Do they get rather old?
Well, I'm going to let Andy chime in on that.
I don't think the actual definitive research has been done on them, but they would live many years. The species actually they don't mate for life as some divers think, but they do have long associations and pair up to spawn. So that individual is no doubt 30 years or more. I would guess, but exact date is yet to be done.
And that's unique to this coast, is it?
Well, wolf eels are found from California. Actually, a new range extension, when we were doing the book, somebody actually found one just south of the U.S.-Mexican border. So they've been found all the way from northern Mexico up into central northern Alaska. So they have a good range.
So you're both fish culturalists. For people that don't know what a fish culturalist is, what do they do?
I'll defer to Phil on that because he did more of that than I did.
Ah.
Okay, well, I worked at a federal hatchery, Robertson Creek Hatchery, and there what we do is we spawn returning adult salmon, incubate the eggs, and rear them through their freshwater life cycle, and then release them to the ocean. So the federal program releases fish for the sport commercial and First Nations food fisheries. It's the idea is to increase their survival through that freshwater stage and contribute to the economy.
Hey, at the one that you worked at Roberts Creek, it was Roberts Creek, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Is it one species that you...
Primarily Chinook. We, Robertson Creek, they release about 6 million Chinook salmon, probably in the neighborhood of 100,000 to 130,000 steelhead, and probably somewhere close to 500,000 coho salmon. And they also fertilize Great Central Lake for the returning sockeye, which, of course, are most of which are lake spawners.
Now, you're talking to a layman, so if some of these questions are inane, you'll forgive me. The temperature on the coast, is that relatively the same up and down the coast? For water, I mean?
Go ahead, Andy.
Certainly the coast of BC is pretty similar. In the summer, the surface layer gets warmer, but other than that, no, it's pretty much the same.
Yeah. Andy, how did you and Phil meet? I understand you both worked at the aquarium at the same time, did you?
Yeah, we met back in 1967, 68, somewhere in there. We were both young fellows going to school, I guess, and we were both hired to sweep floors at the Vancouver Aquarium, and that's not why we wanted to work at the aquarium, but that's where all the boys started anyway at that point in time. So we met up at that point, and it's been a long and very great friendship that we've had in the interim.
The first edition of the book, as I said, came out in 1986, 24 years ago. It looks off. I haven't seen the first edition, but it probably looks different than this one.
Oh, very much so. It's very much last century's book.
Yeah.
And it had all the color in the front, what they call ganged in the front, and then the rest of the material was in the back. We were a couple of young fellows who, I guess, were a little brazen at the point and thought we knew enough about fish to do a book, and Harbor had not done any field guide marine-oriented things at all, so Howard White kind of took a chance on us, I guess, and it worked out fine, and it was a very successful book. I still get a lot of good comments about it, and we had a lot of fun doing it, some trials and tribulations, but I think both of us are still proud of that book. It's just that 24 years is a long time.
Well, what's changed, Andy, in terms of the species that you find in our part of the world?
Well, that's a great question. Essentially, not very much, really, if you look long-term. We have our species that are here year-round, or like the salmon migrate in and out. There are some species that come up from the south a little bit more when there's El Nino events or warming events in the summer, but that's always been in play. So not a great deal, I think, has changed. Populations have changed, and I guess what I like to tell people is when they ask about the book and what's changed, I say, well, essentially the species of fish have remained virtually the same, but their entire world around them has changed, and particularly how humans have affected their world, and so the fish are pretty much the same. It's just we've had and the environment's had an effect on them.
Hey, Phil, in terms of the photos of the book compared to the first book, you've seen new technology, I guess, in book publishing.
Yeah.
You're able to have color photos, I guess, in this one as opposed to the previous one, right?
Well, we had the previous one was color photos as well, but Andy mentioned earlier that the photographs in the first edition were blocked, and one of the reasons they blocked them is because you have to make a color separation for each image, but if you block a number of images on a page, they could make one color separation for the page, so it kept the cost down. Now, what's happened now, of course, with they don't have to make those color separations anymore with digital images. So because there's a cost effectiveness to using digital images and not using those color separations anymore, then we were able to have a color plate or several color plates with each fish. I know when I use guidebooks, I've got some bird guides where you have to go to one page for the text and then another page for the range map and the photograph, and certainly it's nice to have those things on one page. So that's what's changed there. A lot of the images in the book are the same images that have appeared in the first book. However, they've been put into a digital format to transfer them to the pages of the new book.
Phil, some of these photos that are underwater, how far is the camera from the actual fish?
Oh, probably. You know, obviously, that depends on the size of the fish. But you know, some of the smaller fish, I might be 8 to 10 inches away, and some of the larger fish, maybe up to a couple of feet. One of the things we try to do when we're photographing underwater is minimize the distance from the camera lens to the subject, simply because you have a turbidity in water that we don't see in air. So if you minimize that distance, the clearer the image is likely to be. Yeah, so we'll be using primarily macro lenses, and then if you've got a really large subject, you be using a wide-angle lens, again, to reduce that distance between subject and camera lens.
And most of the species, I hate to paint a wide brush here, but most of the species, in terms of if you're underwater with them, do they are they pretty docile, or do they go away? Or
no, well, most fish you can approach. Now, some of the, of course, the silver-sided fish like salmon and mackerel and tuna, and those are they're difficult to get close to. So some of the fish that were difficult were actually anesthetized and then released, and we were able to capture photographs when they still hadn't when they still hadn't fully recovered and would take off.
And then you've got some photos here of fish that are on grass, I guess, or on rocks.
Right.
Would
okay.
that be the case with that?
Well, those were additions, and they were the I think in most cases those are the spawning
right.
salmon.
Yeah.
So often they had died. So yes and no, but yeah. We thought it was easier, and I think most people that would see a spawned-out salmon are likely to see it when it's dead on the side of a bank of a river, as opposed to swimming in amongst them. So.
Here's another dumb question. Is spawning salmon, because I noticed in the photographs that compared to the salmon that we see in stores and the sort, they're darker. They're sort of bigger, I guess,
right.
And they're reddish, obviously.
Yeah.
Are they inedible?
It depends on the stage of it depends on the species, and it depends on how long they've been in fresh water. Because a lot of the coho, for example, that come back as silver bright fish in fresh water, especially early on, are very good shape, and actually First Nations. Harvest those and utilize them for food fish. Now, if you looking at those sockeye in the book and some of those that are more advanced, they're past eating. But so it's species dependent and how long they've been in fresh water.
Andy, in the book you talk about no-take marina protected areas. Are there a lot of those up and down this coast?
Unfortunately not, and that's a pet peeve of mine, I guess, and one of the reasons we, I guess, continue on this with this event that I'm on. In BC, we actually have, in Canada, there's only two no-take marine protected areas. They're postage stamp size ones. There's one at White Cliff and one at Porteau. Recently, in the United States, particularly in California, they've gone a lot further than we have, and there's a lot of areas down there that they've made no-take marine protected areas, and it's in response to their rockfish stocks that have dwindled rapidly, and it's rather frustrating here. We seem to lag behind the rest of the world, but unfortunately, no, we do not have very many no-take marine protected areas here.
And what's the reason for that? The government's lack of will, or?
Yeah, I guess it's somewhat complicated, but I think from my perspective, it seems yes. The short answer would be yes, and you if you talk to people in government, you'll get a number of potential reasons why not and the problems that are incurred. But it seems like many other countries around the world have set these things up in their areas, and they've overcome similar difficulties. New Zealand is a prime example. They have a marvelous set of no-take marine protected areas that started back in the late 70s, and a lot of effort went into the first one, and now they have a complete set of them throughout, and everybody's behind it. You know, we do have issues, but you know, they're not issues that other countries haven't had and dealt with. I guess you'd have to probably ask somebody in Ottawa why we can't move forward. It's been frustrating, to say the least.
My dad used to work on a tugboat, and he used to fish regularly. And I gave him the book for a day or so, and he's sort of savvy when it comes to fishing. He was talking to me about red snapper.
Yep.
And I guess you can buy that in I guess, at Granville Island here in Vancouver or in Chinatown. That's not what it's called, right?
Yeah, a red snapper is actually a species of rockfish, our local rockfish grouping, and they're a primarily a North Pacific family. Red snapper, the true red snapper, a snapper is a type of fish in another family, and there are quite a few different species of red snapper around the world, but they're primarily in tropical areas. If you went down this coast as far as Mexico and Central America, you would find quote-unquote red snappers down there. Ours is actually one of the largest rockfish species that we have, and actually a poster child, I think, for marine protected areas because of their biology. The large red snapper that your father probably caught when he was on the tugboats and what have you, a large female red snapper, a yellow-eyed rockfish, correctly, it would be 20, 25 pounds, and a fish of that stature would probably be 90 to 100 years old, and no doubt a female and capable of producing 100,000, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of young. So when you take something like that out of the population, you're removing, that's the prime reproductive individual, and as somebody once told me, it's the in rockfish land, it's the old fat females that are the sexy ones.
There is a photograph of one in the front of the book. That one that's pregnant, it says there that it's 90 years of age?
Yes, probably. I mean, we didn't age that specimen, but it would be close to that. Most rockfish don't mature, are not capable of reproducing until they're 15 to 20 years old. And the older and bigger the females get, the more young they're capable of producing, and the better the young, they're healthier, they're better young specimens than the young females give birth to. So that's where it's really critical to have no-take marine protected areas, somewhere where some of these can continue to reproduce.
Just on that point, if I can back up just a little bit, Andy talked about the New Zealand example. What's really interesting there, and I believe the Aboriginal native population are Maoris in New Zealand, and they had opposed a big marine protected area there early on. But what they found after that area had been protected for a number of years, it was actually seeding adjacent fishing areas that the Maori used. So they were, in the end, they were kind of pleased with the results. And I think one of the things that inhibits larger or more marine protected areas here on our coast is the user groups, the sport commercial fisheries, are fairly powerful lobby and are reluctant to often give up areas where they fish.
So. Right. Phil, sharks, are they ubiquitous in this region? Do we have a lot of species?
Well, I'm going to defer to Andy, but I think we have about eight, somewhere in the neighborhood of eight species that I can think of locally. Not, a lot of them are deeper water sharks that weren't, a lot of sport divers or anglers are not likely to see, but I'll let Andy fill you in on that.
Yeah, I think Phil's right on that. We have, there's probably around 15 that have actually been recorded, and some of these come north with El Nino events, and there's the ones that live here regularly. But the great white is the famous great white shark that everybody knows about is recorded commonly along our shores, much to the surprise of most people, and one or two of the very largest great whites ever taken were found washed ashore on the west coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands. So we do have a fairly decent array of sharks, much to the surprise of most people.
Yeah. Andy, this past summer we've had a lot of talk over the sockeye salmon stocks.
Right.
What does that all mean? Is that good news? Should we be encouraged? Should we be worried, perhaps?
Well, that's certainly what the subject of debate over the last month has been, and it's just amazing to me the complete turnaround here, and it shows, I think, what little we really know and how difficult it is to forecast these things. DFO, I think they do their very best to try to make these forecasts, but it's really difficult. They can count the fish as they leave their streams at places like Robertson Creek, where Phil worked, and they can count them when they come back. But once they get out in the ocean, it's like a big black box, and nobody really knows precisely where they go and what's going on. So these things, this has been going on for years, runs that were not as good as they should have been, and then runs that were better. The last 2 years is kind of an extreme example of this, and because we've had some lean years for a while, this has been particularly noteworthy, and everybody is talking about it, and rightly so. As far as whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic, I don't know. I don't think this run should make us really optimistic, and I think we need to try to take more effort to ensure that our salmon streams and the environment is looked after. I think Phil might have a better perspective on that.
I think what we do know is that, I mean, the ocean's a big sort of black box, and we know a lot about the freshwater life cycle stages, and we have a lot of data and statistics on that. But when they go to the ocean, that's the end of our data. But Andy mentioned El Nino years, and you were talking about temperature earlier. When we have El Nino years and the Pacific warms up here off the north coast, we know that food production is not as good, and the zooplankton and phytoplankton sort of flourish in when we have these cool upwelling regimes. So a lot of whether or not salmon come back in big abundances in terms of the ocean relates to the abundance of food. And what's interesting is I think we're in a cool water regime now, so you would expect some fairly decent ocean survivals. The sockeye have done very well, I understand, the Fraser River, and we've had a terrific run here, probably the best run in 20 years into the SOMAS system. And yet our Chinook returns are not good, so there's still lots of questions. I think the different species have different routes through the Pacific, so maybe the sockeye stocks have gone through areas with large abundance of food, but I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Is fish a regular part of your own diet?
Yes, mine.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I think I could become a piscivore myself and eat lots of veggies and seafood. I think it's, when I was a kid, of course, the oceans were talked about as a bottomless pit, and we're going to feed the world's population. And in our lifetime, now we're to the point where we realize that that's not the case. But obviously, it's very, the resources there are very important to maintaining our position on the planet in terms of the populations that we now have. I like to eat fish, but I think we need to make sure that it's going to be there for our children and grandchildren, too.
Phil and Andy, it's been a great pleasure to have you both on the program. You guys have done a great job with this book, and I believe a great service as well. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Coastal Fishes of the Pacific Northwest, the revised and expanded second edition from Harbor Publishing. It sounds like a textbook, but it's not. It's a great-looking, useful, and interesting book. Its authors, Andy Lamb and Phil Edgell, on the line. Phil Edgell joining us from Port Alberni, and Andy Lamb from Thetis Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunder.